And so while soldiers are not waiting for the political great white hope to appear and to save them and are making their way, and the American people in increasing numbers are having more courage and demanding accountability and asking the right questions, I must just say, just for a moment, a couple of words about the duopoly running this country right now. I think it's time we have some healthy alternatives to the Republican and Democratic Party. When I see the Hillary Clintons of the Democratic Party that just can't figure out if it makes sense to withdraw the troops in this illegal war, that makes me really committed to building third parties in this country. And Mr. Galloway can show us how, his model shows us how, that you don't have to be afraid, that you can offer true leadership, and that, hey, even running for a local city council office makes a tremendous difference, because we grow alternatives on every level. And we, as we start to have real alternatives and choices, we have more choices for cereal than we do for our, you know, our elected officials. Go to whole aisle, right? We need more choices in this country so that we can begin to have an expression of the movement and take our country back to defend the liberty and the rights that this country purports to be about, and which is we are really, really in danger of losing. And so we have tonight a fabulous model of an unafraid, a courageous leader who tells it like it is, and who models for us here in America that we don't have to be afraid to fight for what's ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amy. I was in New York City in the East Village in an Indian restaurant, and the owner said, "You're George Galloway, aren't you?" We got into a restaurant this morning, and the Iraqi owner of that restaurant said, "You're George Galloway, aren't you?" We got in a cab this afternoon, and the Egyptian owner of that cab said, "You're George Galloway, aren't you?" Many people here first heard of George Galloway on May 17th when he told the U.S. Senate what he thought of them and what we all think of them. But many, many people in the Arab and Muslim world have long known George Galloway as a defender of rights of Arabs and Muslims, as a proponent of freedom for Palestine. His new book is Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington. It is on sale in the lobby. You owe it to yourself to buy a copy and then come up on stage afterwards and get it signed. And San Francisco, just yesterday, the City Council, Board of Supervisors, thanks to Supervisor Ross McCrimmy and Chris Daly, unanimously voted to welcome George Galloway to San Francisco because of his opposition to occupation and war. And I ask you, too, to welcome George Galloway to San Francisco.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Wow. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. Wassalamu alaikum. Peace be with every one of you. And thank you to the City of San Francisco for their official welcome. Welcome is even more welcome for me. And I want to start out by telling you what I'm not going to talk about before I tell you what I am. Especially because my name is George, I'm not going to try and recolonize the United States of America. I'm declining all invitations, and I've had many, believe me, to renounce my British citizenship and take up citizenship of the United States and run for office. But when I look at the governor of California, no, when I look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, I don't think we should take the risk of changing the Constitution here in the United States of America. But I will be back, and again and again, if you'll have me, because I put it this way, if our two countries can be the biggest rogue states in the world, stand shoulder to shoulder with each other, then those of us in those two countries who stand against our leaders must stand shoulder to shoulder with each other across the ocean and across the time zones. And anyway, I've always hated imperialism. I come from an Irish background. One day I came home and told my Irish grandfather that the teacher had said that the British had an empire so vast that upon it the sun never set. And my grandfather answered, "That's because God would never trust the English in the dark." And I never had any reason to doubt him. The second thing I'm not going to be doing here this evening is parading any kind of anti-Americanism. I'm accused on a daily, almost hourly basis by the crazed neocons who seem to inhabit your airwaves, including a madman today, Ron, what was his second name? Ron Owens, my God. I thought I'd stumble into Fox by mistake. I thought it was Bill O'Reilly I'd come before. They accuse me of a visceral anti-Americanism. Let me let you in on a secret. I'm the great-grandson of probably the only woman in the 19th century who emigrated from America to Scotland at a time when thousands were sailing in the opposite direction. I think she got on the wrong boat, but if she had not, I would not be here this evening. So there's nothing anti-American about me or about anybody in the anti-war movement. We want a special relationship with the people of the United States, even though, as Oscar Wilde said, we were two people divided by a common language. We just want a special relationship that's a little more dignified than the one Miss Lewinsky had with President Clinton, which requires the weaker partner to be always on their knees. We say, let's have a special relationship where we genuinely respect each other as equal partners across the seas. And the third thing I'm not going to be doing here tonight is speaking against the troops. There are some crazed junior neocons following me around wearing T-shirts that say, "We love the troops." Well, we love the troops too. That's why we don't want any more of them to be killed or to kill for George Bush and Tony Blair and the pack of lies that they represent. After all, who are the troops? The troops are young men and women from both our countries, conscripted by unemployment and low wages and poor prospects and racism and industrial dereliction in the forgotten territories of your country and mine. War, it was once said, is a thing where a worker stands at either end of a rifle, each of them trying to kill each other for the bosses who are ready to fight to other people's blood, and we want no part of it. And the fourth thing I'm not going to be saying here this evening is anything in support of the mass murderers of Al-Qaeda, of Bin Laden, of the killers of 9/11, or of 7/7, or of Madrid. We say to the right wing in this country, Bin Laden has nothing to do with us. It was you who invented Bin Laden and the Taliban and the so-called Mujahideen. It was you. You know, I said on the eve of the fall of Kabul to Bin Laden and the fathers of the Taliban, the so-called holy warriors in Afghanistan, I said to Mrs. Thatcher in Parliament, you have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And what's happened? We punished the Afghan people by sending them Bin Laden, and then we punished them all over again for having been occupied by Bin Laden in the first place. And I say, as I said in Parliament 4 days after 9/11, when we heard Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Bush Jr., I'm going to come back to Mrs. Bush Sr. later on. Mrs. Bush Jr. and Mrs. Blair, in a kind of synchronized swimming in the grief that followed 9/11, when they invited us never to forget those heartbreaking messages of farewell, those heartbreaking messages of love left by those American women from their mobile telephones on the answering machines of their from aboard those aeroplanes, as if we could ever forget. But just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths any less obscene than the deaths of those American women on board those aeroplanes. People asked me after that debate, well, what would you do to deal with this menace of Islamist fundamentalist terrorism? And I said this: you may think that these aeroplanes that struck the Twin Towers came out of a clear blue sky, but I believe that they emerged from a swamp of hatred and bitterness and enmity against us, constantly watered by our policies of injustice against the Muslim people of the world. And this is a truth that simply must be grasped. And people say, well, what would you do? Do you want to negotiate with these mass murderers? I say, no, you can't negotiate with Bin Laden. We have to negotiate with those Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who might join him tomorrow if we continue the policies of injustice around the world. These are the people with whom we must negotiate. And how do we do it? Well, the first thing we must do, and I realize, and if I didn't realize it before, I realized it after my hour with the Ron, whose name I keep forgetting, earlier this morning on the local radio. In America, more than anywhere else in the world, because most places in the world have already woken up to this truth, but you have not yet in this country woken up to it, and it's this: until there is justice for the Palestinian people, there will be no peace in the Middle East and no peace, therefore, around the world. It's really It's really quite simple, you know. It's really quite simple. It's not rocket science. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. You have to waken up to that fundamental truth, because the Palestinian people are not prepared to go into the museum of ex-nations. They are not prepared to be a museum piece. They decided long ago to stand up and to fight for their rights as a free people. And we have a duty to do everything we can to come to their assistance. Friend of mine who's doing my timekeeping, Ron Mackay, he and I met in 1977, nearly 30 years ago, in two adjoining Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila. Last week was the 23rd anniversary of the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. Many people in America and in Britain didn't even notice the anniversary. Many never even heard or want to hear about the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. Let me remind you what happened there. The Palestinian fighters had left Beirut by international agreement brokered by the United States of America, with a guarantee signed by the United States ambassador that the families they left behind in the refugee camps, their wives, their children, their elderly parents, would be protected from harm by the so-called international community. And no sooner had the ships bearing the Palestinian fighters left the harbor when thousands of Israeli soldiers and their Lebanese fascist allies descended like wolves upon the defenseless refugees of these camps and massacred thousands of them, their bodies lying bloated in the sun for many days thereafter, a sight which was to become familiar elsewhere later. Now, who was in charge of that massacre? General Ariel Sharon was actually, literally standing at the gate of those camps. He was in charge of the floodlighting of those camps so that the butchers of Beirut could go about their killing spree. The same Ariel Sharon who was welcomed with a red carpet last week in New York when he attended the United Nations, and we were invited to welcome and honor and be grateful to Ariel Sharon because he gave $250,000 of your money each to 7,000 settlers who had been living on stolen land for 40 years. We were asked to be grateful to the Sharon that George Bush described as a man of peace. Even Sharon doesn't describe himself as a man of peace, but George W. Bush thinks he's a man of peace. Now, Ron Mackay and I visited 4 years ago another camp called Jenin. It was still smoldering from another massacre where another large number of Palestinian refugees, supposedly protected by the so-called international community, were massacred. This time, General Sharon was not the defense minister, He was the prime minister in charge of the massacre of Jenin. We walked, and by the way, to the heckler, there's something unique about Jenin you should know. Jenin is the only refugee camp where the Palestinian refugees have lived for 50 years, where if they climb up on the roofs of their houses, they can see the shining city of Haifa, which was their city. They can see their own houses from their refugee camp being lived in by foreigners from Toronto and Brooklyn and London and Paris. They can see their own trees being picked by foreigners while they live in a rancid, rat-infested hovel which was then invaded by Sharon's soldiers and its inhabitants massacred. And the Security Council uniquely met on a Saturday night unanimously for a change. This time the U.S. banned the international wave of revulsion and vetoed the resolution. The Security Council passed a resolution demanding that Sharon allow United Nations inspectors to enter the camp in Jenin to check on reports of mass destruction amongst the Palestinian refugee population. And Sharon answered them on the Sunday morning. He said, "There will be no United Nations inspectors entering this camp or entering the occupied territories." He told them to get stuffed. And you know what? They promptly got stuffed. They packed their suitcases and went home and never said another word about it again. And this double standard, whereby Iraq was broken on the wheel of sanctions and war, on what grounds? On the grounds of the unacceptability of acquiring other people's territory by force. On the grounds that United Nations Security Council resolutions must be upheld and implemented. On the grounds that no country may seek weapons of mass destruction. Yet there is no country in the world which has broken more United Nations resolutions than Sharon's Israel. No country in the world which has acquired more territory from other people by force and held on to it for longer than Sharon's Israel. And as we know, thanks to the brave Jewish whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu, Israel is sitting on a mountain of weapons of mass destruction, including hundreds of nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver them. Israel is not punished for these, but rewarded endlessly by the United States taxpayer and the United States defense industries, which ensures that every bullet in the back of a Palestinian child in the Gaza Strip is paid for by you and manufactured by you. Every helicopter gunship which swoops out of the sky to fire rockets at the refugees is paid for by you and delivered by your government. And isn't it one of the great ironies that the weapons they're using in Palestine and Iraq have names like Tomahawk and Apache, names redolent of the Native American people who themselves were subject to genocidal mass murder by settlers here in your own country. And the second reason why that swamp of hatred is so deep, appears equally difficult for the United States and Britain to grasp. And it is the policy of propping up every puppet president and corrupt king who rules the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. And because of that, the Muslims don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear Bush and Blair talking about democracy and human rights. They saw the funeral of King Fahd, a tyrant, thief, who turned his country into a personal bank account, which he looted for decades, spending the proceeds in the bordellos and the casinos and the arms bazaars and the stock markets and the banks of Western countries like yours and mine. The Saudi dictatorship has $6 trillion, trillion, in the American banks and the American stock exchange alone. And the reason why these Western leaders went there to bury the tyrant, to kiss the nose as a prelude of kissing somewhere else of his successor, was to ensure that the dictatorship continues to govern Saudi Arabia, not in the interests of its own people or of the Arab people or of the Muslim people, but in the interests of the Bush family, the Carlyle group, and all those parasites who are feeding off the wealth of the people of the Muslim world. There are many other examples I could give. If I had time, I could talk to you about Hosni Mubarak, who's just been elected in what he told us was the first ever free presidential election in Egypt, which was quite an admission, as he'd been elected president 4 times before. But you know, something funny happened on the way to the polls, which hardly anybody seems to have noticed. Mubarak got more votes in the so-called free election last month than he got in the rigged election 6 years before. He got 84.6% of the vote in the rigged election and 88.4% of the vote in the free election. Go figure. The Egyptians know that this is a farce, that the United States doesn't want free elections in Arabia or in Egypt, because the first thing that any free government in Arabia or Egypt would do would be to kick out the American military bases, close the Israeli embassy, and begin to govern their country in the interests of their own people. I'll give you just one more. Do you remember the general? Do you remember Mr. Bush before he was elected, or rather selected, as president first time out? He was interviewed by a plucky reporter. We wouldn't get near him today. Do you remember he asked him for the names of the international leaders that Mr. Bush would have to deal with if he was elected? The reporter asked him, "Do you know who's the leader of Pakistan?" Bush grinned and said, "Sure, the general." And the reporter said, "Well, can you be a bit more specific? Maybe a name or something." And Bush thought for a moment or five and said, "We just call him the general." Well, of course, he was just the general then, a man who had come to power in a military coup, who was suspended from the British Commonwealth, placed under an arms embargo. He was just the general then. But the day after 9/11, he became not the general, but the president. He became the president who was welcomed to develop nuclear weapons. He became the president who was given all the money and all the arms and all the support that he required, not because he was representing the wishes of the people of Pakistan, but because he was representing the wishes of George W. Bush. And what do you think the people in Pakistan or Egypt or Saudi Arabia feel when they hear Bush talking about democracy in the Muslim world? I tell you, they feel bitter and angry, and we fill again that swamp out of which these monstrous mosquitoes came on 9/11, on 7/7, and on so many other occasions. And the third and most serious of all of the contributory factors to this swamp are the monstrous crime that was committed by you and us against the people of Iraq. At every 6 minutes of every day and night, year after year, for more than a million Iraqi children, and called it an embargo. The late Pope John Paul II called it the slaughter of the innocents. The Democratic whip on the Hill, David Bonnier of Michigan, called it infanticide masquerading as politics. Very few people in the West cared about those little Iraqi children being laid in the biggest mass grave of them all. But every Muslim in the world cared about it. Every Muslim in the world knows about it. And it's another big reason why so many hundreds of millions of people grew to hate us so intensely that many were ready to hurt us, exchanging their lives for many of ours. So I said we need to drain this swamp by reversing these three main policies. But we didn't. We compounded every one of those crimes. We made the swamp even deeper. We compounded the crime against the people of Iraq by a massive invasion of hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers. And we were told a pack of lies to justify it. Lies which now stand naked and exposed in front of the world to the extent that even Colin Powell, the man who went to the Security Council with his overhead projection and his telephone intercepts and dazzled the world with a display of propaganda that Joseph Goebbels would have been proud of to fool the world into the need for attacking Iraq. He said it's a stain on his reputation. You're right, Mr. Powell. It's a blood stain on your reputation and on the reputation of the entire U.S. government. They said there was weapons and there were none. They said Iraq was linked to 9/11 and it was not. They said that Iraq was connected to Al-Qaeda and it wasn't then, but it certainly is now. And whose fault is it that there's now Al-Qaeda all over Iraq? Bush and Blair brought Al-Qaeda into Iraq by savagely attacking it in 2003. But the biggest lie of all that they told was the one that they told to our own soldiers. When they told them that these invading armies would be welcomed by the people of Iraq with rice and flowers. And there are now 2,000 dead American boys and girls lying in the ground as testimony to that lie. There are 15,000 Americans wounded and maimed, many of them in wheelchairs for the rest of their lives, as a testimony to those lies. And believe me, I don't know how many Americans died today. I know that 8 died the day before. I wouldn't be surprised if 8 died today and another 8 died tomorrow. And if you don't want that 2,000 to become 10 and then 20 and then 30 and then 40,000 and then 58,000 dead like you lost in Vietnam, then you better raise your voices for the withdrawal of the American armed forces of Iraq now. Because as I warned, and the anti-war movement warned, this gruesome twosome Bush and Blair, who couldn't punch their own way out of a paper bag, whose own sons and daughters will never be putting on a tin hat and picking up a gun and going there. It's the sons and daughters of other mothers and fathers they send. These liars, these criminals were warned, you are opening the gates of hell with this invasion, and the Iraqis will fight you with their teeth if necessary, and for as long as is necessary until they drive you from their land. Because the Iraqi people are not less than us. It could never happen to you, but it nearly happened to us when we stood alone in 1941 against the fascist hordes at the Channel ports ready to invade us. And if Hitler had invaded our country, every person with self-respect and dignity, whether they supported Churchill or hated Churchill, would have fought the Nazi occupation of our country with every bone in their body and every breath until they had driven it from their land. And the Iraqis are not less than us. They do not love their country any less than us. Don't tell me that if the British and Americans leave, there'll be chaos. The only person who can say that is a person who doesn't have a television set or who's never listened to the radio over these last 2 years. There is already bloodshed and chaos in Iraq, and it will not be a sufficient condition to end that for the British and American armies to withdraw, but it is a necessary condition for the British and American armies to withdraw. There will be no solution unless the British and American armies withdraw. Which brings me to a few points I need to make in conclusion. I told you earlier that one of my favorite parliamentarians was a man called Charles James Fox. His statue is the first one you come upon when you enter the British Parliament through the St. Stephen's entrance. He was twice expelled from the British Parliament. The first time for supporting the American Revolution, the great freedom struggle of the American people to kick out the colonial occupiers of their country. The second time he was expelled was for his support for the French Revolution, which admittedly was quite pointedly expressed. He tabled a resolution congratulating the people of France on the execution of their king and queen. And looking forward to the same fate befalling all the crowned heads of Europe. But just imagine going back in time and saying to Mr. Fox, are you sure you're doing the right thing supporting these anti-colonial revolutionaries? I mean, what if they win? What if their country ends up being run by a bunch of crazed fundamentalist fanatics like the Reverend Pat Robertson, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, and the rest of the gang? Don't tell me George Bush is a follower of Jesus, because I just don't believe it. I just don't believe it. Christians believe in the prophets, peace be upon them. Bush believes in the prophets and how to get a piece of them. That's his religion. That's the religion Bush follows. But Fox would have answered, "It is for the American people alone to decide who governs their country. It is not a matter for me in the country which occupies them to dictate to them which political leaders they should follow." Now, I told you earlier I was of Irish extraction. This is very important for the coming months. When the Irish people rose at Easter time in 1916 and seized the General Post Office in O'Connell Street in Dublin and proclaimed the Irish Republic, dealing a decisive blow to the British Empire, the liberals in London, the Christopher Hitchens of their day, declined to issue a certificate of approval to the Irish revolutionaries. They said these revolutionaries are priest-ridden, bog-trotting, Celtic, Gaelic obscurantists who may take Ireland out of the empire, yes, but take it into the mists of some Celtic brigadoon. But these Hitchens of their day missed the important certificate of approval that's required was the certificate issued by the Irish people to the Irish revolutionaries, and the views of the British liberals was of no consequence whatsoever. I mention it because you will be told that you might not like the British and American occupation of Iraq, but if they withdraw, Iraq will be governed by people who don't even look like you. Well, that's something we'll have to get used to, because when the British and Americans leave, the one thing you can be sure of is that Iraq will be governed by Iraqis and not British and American generals and politicians in London and Washington. And that is how it should be. Now, I said I'd come back to Mrs. Bush Sr. Now, I don't know. I mean, I'm reading the American press now. And sorry. No, it is a sorry sight in many respects, but even in the American press, you can discern the enormous sense of shame and outrage felt in this country at the pitiful, pathetic, shameful performance by your government in the wake of the Hurricane Katrina that hit the Gulf Coast. I can see it even in the right-wing newspapers. This sense of amazement. And I'm here to tell you that for the rest of the world, who knew that the Bush administration were malevolent crooks, we now know that on top of being malevolent crooks, they're a bunch of utter pitiful incompetence who can't even pick up the bodies of their own citizens in one of their own great cities. Days and days and days after the elements have taken them. BBC, last week, a British journalist confronted an American officer and said, "Isn't anybody going to pick up that dead body there, which I first filmed 7 days ago and it's still lying there, despite the continual passage of American forces of one kind or another?" And the officer answered, "We have no orders to pick up dead bodies, sir." So they've got orders to create dead bodies from Afghanistan to Iraq, but no orders to pick up dead bodies in their own country, in the great city of New Orleans. I tell you, the Bush administration now stands naked in front of the whole world, and it's a very ugly sight indeed. And I believe my comrade Todd was right when he said, it's not enough to rub your hands and count the years to the next presidential election, when maybe, though it's unlikely, the Democrats will choose somebody with enough backbone to stand up to these criminals and fight them face to face on the grounds that they should. It's not enough to do that. We can't wait that long. Nixon was impeached for far less than George W. Bush is guilty of, and it's time to raise the demands in London and in Washington for the impeachment of these criminals and their defeat by the people. And we have a chance to do it. Cindy Sheehan and Hurricane Katrina. Cindy Sheehan and Hurricane Katrina have changed the political landscape here in the United States of America. If the Democrats had any guts, they'd be capitalizing on it now instead of hiding, because they're complicit in it on both counts. And in Britain, the landscape has shifted too. Yes, Tony Blair won re-election, but he lost half of his majority. He's lost more than half of his members. He lost 1 million votes, and his reputation is utterly destroyed. No one believes a word that he has to say, and in the history books, he'll be remembered for nothing other than having gotten into the back seat of a drunk driver's car who drove it over a cliff and caused the deaths of a very large number of people without having reached the bottom yet. I brought my comrade all the way from Scotland to remind me that I didn't finish the point about Barbara Bush. When the French Queen, that Charles James Fox congratulated the French people for executing, was told that the masses in France were rising for they had no bread, she answered, Marie Antoinette answered, then why don't they eat cake? Wasn't that really what Barbara Bush was saying when she went to that Astrodome and told these poor people there never had it so good? Underprivileged people being fed with bread handouts in an Astrodome, and her main worry about them was that too many of them wanted to stay on in Texas once it was all over. These Bourbon Bushes and the Bourbon Blair have to face, metaphorically speaking, alas, the same fate as the Bourbons before them. And we are the people who have to do it. In the last 2 days, the landscape in Britain has begun to shift in a landslide as a result of the events in Basra, which some of you will have read about, though I've not been able to find it in many American papers so far, where British soldiers dressed up as Arabs, reportedly carrying explosives on their way to do God knows what, though we can speculate, can't we, drove through a roadblock and killed some Iraqi policemen, were arrested and taken to prison, a prison which was then invaded by British tanks who smashed it down to rescue the two undercover British soldiers in defiance even of the puppet regime that we ourselves installed there. And those tanks were then set on fire by the furious masses of the city who will not accept their country being treated as a colonial possession. And I said, and I've been saying since the fall of Baghdad, which I warned them would not be the beginning of the end, but merely the end of the beginning, that the British forces in the south of Iraq were just one fatwa away from a terrible disaster, a bloodbath. The blood, of course, not of Blair, but of the young men he sent on a lie to stand there in amidst these very angry people in the south of Iraq. And today, on Sky News, the Fox equivalent, owned by Rupert Murdoch, on a program Bill O'Reilly would be pleased to host, they held a poll, and 86% of the respondents said, bring the British Army home from Iraq right away, right away. So I tell you, if I may be allowed to quote Lenin in an American high school, Lenin said, there are decades when nothing happens, but there are weeks when decades happen. We're heading for those weeks. We have to seize those weeks. You and me, the Americans and the British together, have to rise up and sweep these criminals out of power before they do any more damage. Wassalamu alaikum. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.